normal, normal, the regular shiur that I give. It pertains to, an inyan, an area of the Haggadah. It pertains to Yetzias Mitzrayim. I mean, of course, it involves some chumash, but the main, essentially, it's not really a chumash shiur, but it's a shiur about a pertaining to Yetzias Mitzrayim. And I just noticed, I gave the shiur in Israel. One of the shiurim that I gave in Israel. And I think that if you study the Haggadah carefully, you cannot help but notice a certain ambivalence. An ambivalence in what happens to be the main theme of the Haggadah. Okay? I want to start off with something. Something that we say in the Haggadah. And it seems to me that a lot of people do not have a clear idea of what it means. It can be confusing. And I've heard people, give explanations which are really very difficult to comprehend. So I just want to start off with that. Now, after the, you understand, we, at a certain point in the Seder, we explain the significance of the objects that we're going to be eating that night, even the ones we're not going to be eating that night, like the Pesach. So that's part of, you're familiar with that, that's part of the Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is the essential mitzvah of the night, to retell the story of the Exodus. And it's retold in many different fashions. Okay? And one of the fashions is through, what's the point of pointing to the Pesach and explaining what the significance of the Pesach is? Then we point to the matzah, and we explain the significance of the matzah, and then we point to the maror. You're familiar with that. The idea, it's not simply a matter of visual aid, although that there is room for that concept. That idea of visual aid is brought into the picture because the main objective of the night is really the children, as you know. That's the real mitzvah. The real mitzvah is to tell over the story to a child, and preferably someone who really never heard the story before, which is not that easy these days because they've been rehearsed in school so well that, they don't come to the Seder with an open mind. So I don't know if that's... I always wondered about that, whether that's a great idea for the schools to prepare the children so well for Pesach, but then it's just performance. And, a spontaneous Seder, which is the way it's supposed to be, where you're supposed to elicit a question from the child and get the child involved in the conversation, that doesn't take place. The point of explaining the significance of the matzah and the maror is to tell the story through explaining the various objects of mitzvah, because these are the objects of the mitzvahs. In other words, the mitzvahs are not just arbitrary. Just from the Haggadah itself, you're obligated to explain the significance of the mitzvah. But the mitzvahs that God commanded us are not just arbitrary, but they have significance in terms of the story, and they represent very important ideas pertaining to the story. Okay. Now, after that part is concluded, we say something. And I just want to hear what your explanation of this is. B'chol dor v'dor, in every generation, chayav adam liros es atzmo, an individual is obligated to see himself, to view himself, kilu hu yatzim im Mitzrayim, as though he had left Egypt. Shenemar v'gadtol avincha b'yam ahu lemor, as it says, see, everything in the Haggadah is supported by a pasuk. As it says, that you shall tell your children on this day, saying, bavur zeh, because of this, Asar Hashem Li, God did to me, B'tzeisi Mimitzrayim. Well, you're supposed to explain to him the reason. The reason for the Exodus. But the reason, the way you explain it is not, it should really be, because of this, God did for my forefathers. But you don't say, God did for my forefathers. You really say, God did for me. So then we say, Lo Asar Hashem Bovod, Go'al HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Not only did God redeem our forefathers from Egypt, El'af Osanu Go'al Imohem. But he redeemed us with them as well. Shenemar, it says, the Osanu Hoshi Misham. And us he took out of there. Laman Havi Osanu, in order to bring us, Los Aslan was ours, to give us the land of Shenishba Lavaseno, that he had promised to his to our fathers. Now, the question is, what does it mean? How does a person fulfill this obligation? It's a chiyuv. It's a chiyuv to envision it as though you yourself had left Egypt. Now, what does that mean? What are you supposed to do? It does sound crazy, but I've heard people say that that's what it means, that you really have to create a scenario in which you imagine yourself, you view yourself as having left Egypt. You put yourself in that situation in fantasy. It's like a fantasy kind of thing. Is that what it means? The Torah demanding from us something which is not true. You know how the Torah insists upon the truth. And the Torah is really against, you know, that whole approach to life, which is based upon dreams and fantasies and so forth and distortions of reality, totally contrary to Torah. I mean, Torah is really reality-oriented. And the Torah says something like this, what is it telling us to do? I mean, I wasn't there. You think, is that what the Torah is saying, that I really was there? I wasn't, to the best of my knowledge, I wasn't there. And I didn't leave. So now I have to envision it as though I was there and I did leave. Well, what kind of significance could that possibly have, other than to confuse my categories of reality? You can't play around with the words and say that it's not really referring to Mitzrayim. It's really referring to Mitzrayim, and we have to envision it as though we left Mitzrayim, but not in a physical way. That's clear. That's absurd. We did not leave. We were not enslaved, and we didn't leave. But it means to say that the real objective of the Exodus was not just the physical, as you know, but it was to transform the mentality of the Jews, to make them into, we'll use the word spiritual, even though it's not a great word, but, you know, to attain a state of freedom. That's the whole essence. And therefore, in that sense, it wasn't just for one particular generation or for two generations, but it was intended to initiate a process and to create a people and a system. And the effects of that would be the effects of something that we experience today. This is something which affects my life, and just as much as it affected the previous generation, and just as much as it affected the original people. The only difference being that they actually were freed from physical bondage. We didn't have to go through physical, but the physical bondage is not the essence anyways, because the Jews were not freed eternally from physical bondage. It means to say that there was an element of freedom that was given to the Jews which was eternal, and that we partake of it. And the whole point of it is to realize that, to appreciate the benefit that was provided by the Exodus, and to see how it relates to you. Now, that's the whole idea. That when God took me out of Egypt. You see? In other words, it was God's intention. It's not accidental that this happens, that God did something, and it just so happens that it exists even now. For example, you could say, like, the fact that we have freedom in America. That's really accidental. It's not that that we have to envision it as though we came over to America. I mean, it just so happened that people escaped from Europe. They set up a system. Hopefully it would last. Maybe it wouldn't last. But they didn't have us in mind. It wasn't in... That was not the intention. Here, the very purpose of the Exodus was to establish a state of true human freedom, cheros. That's the essence. Because it said geula, redemption. Let's use the word redemption. That's a good word. Geula, that's the theme. Lovas avaseinu b'vad gal. God did not only redeem our fathers, but God redeemed us with them. So the redemption that took place, there's a certain redemption. And of course, redemption means from what? From slavery to freedom. And by freedom, we're talking about the freedom of the soul. We're not talking about physical freedom, because the Jews have been enslaved physically many times. But one thing the Jews have never been enslaved is, from the standpoint of the soul, the enslavement of the soul. That's, by the way, the proof that we have to relate the historical experience to ourselves is in what follows next. Hallel. Hallel. That's why do we recite Hallel. The recitation of Hallel is for something when miracles occur. If a person experiences something of miraculous salvation, so he has to give praise to God. So we have to say, the first part of the Seder really culminates with the recitation of Hallel. And that's only after you say this, only after you achieve a state where you partake of the miracle. So now it's your miracle. Now it relates to me. So it's my miracle. So obviously you have to give praise to God. Just like the people who are actually physically redeemed as well. But over here is that the objective of the night of Pesach, that's another shir, the objective of the night of Pesach was geula, was redemption. Of course, redemption included physical freedom, but much, much more as well. Not just the psychological, but also what we refer to as the soul, the spiritual, the freedom of the mind. Okay? Now, if that's the case, the whole concept of what B'chol Dor V'Dor is saying is that we should realize that we attained the freedom that night. That as a result of the Exodus, we attained the freedom. Now I'm saying it's a spiritual freedom, and that's an eternal freedom, which can never be taken away from the Jewish people. Is that this idea that the Jews achieved freedom, eternal freedom, and that we're now a free people, it seems to me that there's ambiguity. That there are certain references which indicate that we're totally free, and there are certain references that indicate that we're not free. And that's what I want to... Is there anything... That's one expression in the Haggadah. Then let's return to the Tfilos. Let's turn to the Davening. This theme is repeated in the Davening. We say it in Myred, in Hashkivenu. When we speak about the Exodus from Egypt, again, we did the same idea. There it is about... I'm sorry, it's in... Before Hashkivenu, it's in Emes Vamuna. The first bracha after the Kriya Shema. He says, refers to the fact that God did also one of Nisim in the Kamal of Paro, that God performed miracles and revenge against Paro, and so forth. Hamaka Biavraso, who smote in his anger, Kol Bechori Mitzrayim, all the firstborn of Egypt, Vayotze Es Amo Yisrael, and took out his nation Israel, Mitocham, from amongst them, Lecheres Olam, to eternal freedom. So that seems to be in line with what we just said, that the objective of Yetzias Mitzrayim was to create a situation of Cheres Olam, eternal freedom. Okay, those are basically those are some of the sources which indicate that that was the whole idea of the Exodus, to not just temporary but eternal freedom. Now, with that in mind, is there anything that you could think of? Any references which seem to contradict what we've just stated? Holach ma'anya. All right? This is the bread of affliction that our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. Okay, whoever is hungry, let him come and eat. Whoever is in need, let him come and share the Pesach with us. All right, let's leave that aside for the time being. Then we say two things, one of which seems exceedingly strange. Hashata acha, now we are here. Hashana ba b'yared Yisrael. And next year may we be in the land of Israel. Alright. Okay, fine. Hashata Avde, now we are slaves. Lashon Haba v'nei Chorin, next year may we be free people. Now, isn't that a contradiction? In other words, how can we be saying that is a reference to our situation? The implication over there is that now we are slaves. Doesn't that contradict what we just said before, which we'll actually say it later, but later on we say that God redeemed us l'cheres olam, that lo atzav aseinu b'levad, that God did not merely redeem our fathers, but God redeemed us as well, and that we share in the redemption, and therefore we're a free people, we're a redeemed people. So if that's the case, then why are we saying that now we're slaves and we're hoping for the redemption for next year? What kind of redemption? We're free. It's a contradiction. The way I see it, it's a contradiction. Can't be both free and enslaved at the same time. We pray to God to blow the great horn, which is what? You know, the Mashiach. For what? For our freedom. Right? Therefore, we're praying to God to bring about circumstances which will ensure our freedom. Meaning to say, now that again is not a prayer for physical freedom, because if that were the case, we wouldn't say it in America today when we have a lot of physical freedom. We're free people. We're not enslaved in any sense of the word. May have more freedom here than in Israel, possibly. But let me just make sure that everybody understands the question. What's bothering me is that there is an ambivalence as to the issue of freedom. On the one hand, we are claiming that we have been redeemed. We're a redeemed people. Cheres Olam, eternal redemption. We're eternally. So you have to. In what sense are we free? All right. So of course, Malki is now going on. I mean, to posit that there are two kinds of freedom. Well, fine, but that's the next step is to explain in what sense. On the one hand, we're claiming to be free people, and we have to envision it, and we have to give praise to God for the freedom. On the other hand, we're complaining that we're not free, and we're awaiting a certain, not just that we're awaiting Mashiach. That's fine, but more than that, we're awaiting freedom. And if you tell me that you're awaiting freedom, then you must say that right now you're not free. So right now you're enslaved. Hashata Avdi. Now, how can you be a slave and a free person at the same time? That's the question for tonight's shiur. This theme itself is really, in my opinion, addressed in the Haggadah. It's good to have a certain overview of the Haggadah. Now, I think you're all familiar with the fact that we say Hallel on the night of Pesach at Seder, okay? But what is unusual about the manner in which we say Hallel? The Hallel is broken up into two parts. Because right after this Laficha, it's interesting the development. First you have the mitzvos. That's interesting too. The order of the Haggadah, you have to study this, the whole study of the Haggadah, the way it's constructed. First you have the elucidation of the mitzvos, what each one signifies. Then you have the Chol Dor V'Dor, and every generation a person has to envision it, what I just read to you, which means you have to relate these historical event to you. It's your history. It's your personal history. In much the same way that a person would tell the history of his family. Let's say an ancestor, a great-great-grandfather, you know, left Europe, came to America, and he set up the whole situation, and he had you in mind. And he set up a system so that you'd be able to have a parnasa, but more than that, you'd be able to have education and so on and so forth. And now you're partaking of it in a natural way. So therefore, you partook of that geula. In other words, when he redeemed himself from that enslavement and set up a new situation, it's not just him. You have to envision it as though it's for you. He did it for you. Then you have Lefichach, which is beautiful. Therefore, we have to give praise. That's an introduction to Hallel, because it's explaining why are we saying Hallel. So we have to give praise, because God did something great for us. Okay? And then what do you do next? You say Hallel. But you don't say the whole Hallel. Hallel is broken up into two parts. You say two paragraphs of Hallel. Halleluka, Hallelujah, Hashem, the first paragraph of Hallel. Then the Tzeis Tzav Mitzrayim. Then you make the bracha at the second coast. And again you say the same thing. Asher Ga'alanu, who redeemed us, for Ga'alas Avoseinu. That's secondary to our fathers. And he brought us to this night to eat matzah and mara. And so on and so forth. That's the first Hallel. Now when do you say the remainder of Hallel? That's the fourth coast. Because then you have the matzah and mara, and then you have the meal. Okay? Then you have the third coast, which you say over what? Birkat Hamazon, the blessing after the meal. And then you have the fourth coast, which is recited over what? Hallel. So the question is, what is the second Hallel for? You have two Hallels. The first Hallel is praise to God over what? Over Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim, over the Exodus. And the fact that it relates to us, that God did a miracle for us. What is the second Hallel all about? Right before the Hallel, you have the coast Shel Eliyahu. Right? And you have that paragraph which says, Shvoch HaMas Chol HaGayim, that God should pour his wrath on the nations because of what they've done to the Jews, because they've destroyed Jacob and so forth. And then you have the coast Shel Eliyahu. Now let me ask you another question. How does that fit into the scheme of things? What's the coast of Elijah? What's it doing at the Seder? Now, the commentaries mention that this is... As I said, the Hallel has to be said over something. Now, the first Hallel is said over Yetzias Mitzrayim, and that relates to us. The second Hallel is said over the Mashiach. It's the Geula HaSida, the future redemption. So therefore, we're incorporated into the Haggadah itself are the two redemptions. That's why Judaism talks about two redemptions. Geulas Mitzrayim, the redemption from Egypt, and what we refer to as Geula HaAsida, the future redemption. Now, that's what I'd like to elucidate tonight, to try and resolve this question, this contradiction between the fact that on the one hand we're saying we're free, on the other hand we're saying we're slaves. And I think it is connected to this idea that there were two Geulos. I mean, Judaism envisions two geulos, two redemptions. The original redemption from Egypt, and apparently, for some reason, it's an incomplete redemption. Because if it was a complete redemption, then why would we be looking forward to a future redemption? And that's the ultimate. The geula asida is the ultimate redemption. But you have to explain to me exactly what did the first redemption achieve, what did it achieve, and what's it lacking, and why are we looking forward to the ultimate redemption, and also why is it, how does this fit into the scheme of the Haggadah? What does that do with the Haggadah? The Haggadah seems to be dealing with the Mitzrayim. What's the connecting link between the Geula of Mitzrayim on the night of the Seder and the future Geula, the Geula HaSida? Okay. That's basically the issue that I'd like to address in the Shiur tonight. On the one hand, there's no question that the Geula of Mitzrayim did achieve a situation of Cheiros, and that's the essence. In fact, what was the Cheiros? Where does the element of Cheiros mean freedom? Where did the freedom come into the picture? Of course, the physical. But we're talking about a different type. We're talking about a human freedom. And where does that come into the picture? When did we achieve that freedom? With the giving of the Torah. And that's what the famous Chazal, it says that the Luchos, concerning the tablets, that it had the script was the writing of God, so to speak. It's a metaphor, obviously. God doesn't write. It means that God caused. A type of writing which was caused by God. It says, Choros ala Luchos, engraved on the Luchos. Now the word Choros is clearly related to the word Cheros. So the rabbi, the drasha is, Cheros ala Luchos. That freedom is to be found in the tablets. And they say, Ein ben Choron, there is no free person except the individual who is Osek Torah. Now that's not so readily apparent. Most people wouldn't say that. They'd say it's a righteous person, he's a tzaddik, he's performing a mitzvah. But they're not saying righteousness there. They're saying freedom. They're talking in terms of real human freedom. And that the only freedom that a person can have is insofar as he's involved in Torah. Yes. So what Malki is saying is like this. And that is to say that Yahweh has a different concept of freedom than any other system. Most systems view enslavement and freedom purely in terms of externals. That's to say, the entire concept of freedom that the world relates to now is purely with regard to freedom from external coercion. But that really is not human freedom. That's just an accident of freedom, a condition. And the truth of the matter is that it is conceivable that a person can have true freedom even if he doesn't have physical liberty. I mean, of course, it's very difficult, and that's why physical liberty is a very important thing, but that's not the essence. Because a person will be enslaved to something else, and that is to his instincts. That's what it means. In other words, an animal really doesn't have, you can't speak of freedom. Why? Because it's a creature of instinct. So the instincts determine its behavior. Now man is a very unusual type of a being. On the one hand, he's an animal, and he has instincts. On the other hand, he has another component which allows him to act in a manner which is contrary to the instincts. But very few people attain that level, and therefore most people live, the basic principle of their existence is determined by their instincts. It's an instinctual existence. And that's why, you see, man, that's the whole idea of Bechira, that man has to create himself. That man is not man, by man I mean human being, by nature. He's only defined as Adam by virtue of how he lives. And I would say that, of course, sophisticated people use a great deal of intelligence. So some of the most, it has nothing to do with intelligence. A person can be a genius. Some of the most brilliant individuals are not living human lives, because it means to say that their intellect is under the service of the instincts, but the prime mover, the determining factor in their existence, in their way of life, is the instinctual. They have never freed themselves from the instinctual. So that person is under coercion. He is just as coerced by the internal, if not more so, than by any external. So basically what has he done is he simply exchanged one ruler for another ruler. That's not true human freedom. So basically Chazal say that that's Cheiros ala Luchos. That it's only, because Chazal say that before the Torah was given there was no real Bechira. That the world really, of course, absent certain individuals. Because Bechira presupposes two possibilities. That a person, on the one hand, every person is affected by his emotions, but you know that the emotions are more than just feelings. They're seducers. They present a certain view of reality. A person doesn't sin unless he's convinced that this is what he really needs, this is what's good for him. It's not the emotion. The emotion, anybody can overcome the emotion as long as he's convinced that it's going to hurt him. It's in the moment of passion a person's convinced that this is the good. Every person is a philosopher. The only thing is, it could be a philosophy which is determined by the instincts, by the desires, or the and that person is living like an animal, and the free person, the truth, is the individual who is living in accordance with the truth, and the truth can only be apprehended by the mind. So therefore, in order to be free, you have to set up a mechanism within yourself where your instincts are subjected to the crucible of reason. That's a truly free person. That's a truly free person. Before Sinai, there was no such freedom. Because there was no Torah. There was no knowledge. There was no objective reality. Like you have in our society today, there's no freedom. Because no one acknowledges that there's any truth. It's all subjectivism. Subjectivism means whatever you feel, and you can rationalize and intellectualize, so that's for you, that's true. For you, that's true. For you, that's true. So basically it means each person lives in accordance with what feels pleasant to him, and then the intellectual rationalizations that go along with that, of course. Of course, it can't be too crude. It's got to be put into a form which makes sense. Now, therefore, there's no freedom in this society. There's no freedom because there's no objective system that you can turn to. We all have emotions, right? We all have emotions. We all have certain feelings. But a person who follows the Torah knows that he has to put aside those emotions. We could discuss an issue. We could have very powerful feelings, and we could have very powerful opinions. But we should all realize that they're pretty meaningless. They're just opinions. Then, the Torah talks about it. So let's go find out. But there too, many people, all they do is they take their emotions, you see, and they bring them into the discussion, and that's not a legitimate form of Torah study. Reeve was raising a good question. That on the one hand, it's true that perhaps it does remove you, it's a good question, from enslavement, from one type of enslavement, but now it just seems that you've again, so now you're a slave to God. And that's what the Torah says. Avadaihem, right, they're my slaves, the law of Adam, love Adam, and not slaves to slaves. So now it just seems that you have to keep a bunch of rules, and those rules, so where's your freedom? Now you still don't have freedom. How is that freedom? Okay, but if you'll accept for the time being the concept that that freedom from enslavement by the instincts, that the instincts, internal, that's mean by internal freedom, that was achieved by the Exodus from Egypt. Okay, so what's lacking? So if that's the case, we now have the Torah, and the Torah is the only gateway to freedom. I mean, I don't know what's Mashiach, you know, in the days of Mashiach, the Rambam makes it clear there'll be no change in the order of nature. All the laws of nature will be in effect as they are. Now, there are other opinions on that. The Ramban has a different opinion. We'll stick with the Rambam for the time being. And the Torah will be restored. In other words, we have the Torah now, but we don't have all the mitzvot now. Because due to the fact that we're in exile and there's no Beis HaMikdash. So essentially, all that's going to happen is that all the laws of the Torah will be restored, and the Jewish people will be restored to Eretz Yisrael, and the Beis HaMikdash will be built, and there'll be a situation of world peace, and there'll be prosperity. You won't have to work too hard. Everything you need. A perfect situation for learning. Alright? Okay. But where's the... So what's new? What is going to be so new about Yemos HaMashiach in terms of its impact upon the issue that we're talking about in terms of providing freedom? Okay? I think there's relevance in a famous chazal. I'm sure this you've all heard. This chazal you've all heard. And that the first geula, the first redemption, was a redemption, but there was something that was lacking. And Chazal expressed this. It's very fascinating. It says to me, when the Jews, you know, when describing the tremendous events that took place at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai, so it says, and Moshe took out the people towards God from the camp. And they stood at the base of the mountain. So Rashi said, the base of the mountain, Chazal said, the base of the mountain, Malameh, that comes to teach us that God turned the mountain over them like some huge dome. Like God took the mountain and he turned it upside down over the Jews like a dome. And he said to them, if you accept the Torah, then it is good. But if not, then this will be your burial place. Now, this is very, very strange. because the Torah itself, if you read the plain text, you know, a Medrash is very nice, but it can't contradict the plain text. The plain text of the Torah indicates that the Jews said Nasavne, you know, that there was negotiations going on, and God gave them the terms of the Torah, and the Jews themselves voluntarily said, Kol Hashem, whatever God said, Nasavneishma, will do. The famous expression, Nasavneishma. If you read the plain text, it seems clear that the Jews accepted the Torah voluntarily. Yet here the rabbis are coming in, and they're saying that no, that they were coerced, that there was an element of coercion over here. How do you explain that? I think it means like this, that it's really true on the conscious level. It doesn't mean to say that there was a gun, that God put a gun at the back of the Jews and threatened them with extinction. If that's the case, then, you know, what do you do with the plain text? It means like this. Then on the conscious level, the Jews did accept the Torah. But you have to ask yourself why. Did they accept the Torah out of love? Or did they accept the Torah out of other reasons? Out of fear? And you know the famous Chazal that says that God went to all the nations and he offered them the Torah? Right, and everyone asked, like, give me, you know, what does the Torah say? And each one, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt, you know, all the, and they all rejected it. Until God came to the Jews, and the Jews said that, we'll do it, we'll keep it. Now, what is the idea behind that story? What is it teaching us? I don't know if we have to take it literally. And if we do, what is the point? Well, who cares? So God gave the others a chance, and they rejected it. So why were the Jews different? Is it normal to accept the Torah, or is it normal to reject the Torah? See, the other nations reflect the idea that Reuven was mentioning. It seems to me that the average mentality, the way people look at life, the average philosophy of the individual would not accept the Torah, because most people associate happiness with the wrong, with unlimited instinctual freedom. And they naturally tend to rebel against any system which places restraints upon their freedom. They know, no, that's the most difficult thing. In fact, that's the most difficult thing with people, you know, people that are struggling to become religious. You know, you macar them, you try to bring them closer. You know what the hardest thing of all is? That commitment. Even if they're keeping Shabbos, and even if they're not eating treif, but they can't tolerate the idea that it's an absolute, that their freedom is good. People feel that they're going to lose in happiness. They associate human happiness with instinctual freedom. So that's why all the nations, as soon as they heard that there's going to be a restriction on their instinctual freedom, they rejected it. Because in their minds, they'd be losing out on happiness. Except for the Jews. And why were the Jews different? Were the Jews such great philosophers? The Jews understood the point that the truth of the matter is that this is the greatest freedom. That the only freedom is a person who's living in accordance with the fulfillment of his real essential component, the Tzelem Elokim. And there's true freedom is to fulfill your purpose. That's what freedom is. Freedom means that you're in line with your purpose. In other words, each creature that God designed has a specific purpose. And to be free means to fulfill your purpose. That's the objective of freedom. If a person is not fulfilling his purpose, then he's not free. Because he's not living in line with his nature. He's living contrary to his nature. Now, man is the only being who has the capacity to live contrary to his nature, because he has the freedom. No other being has the capacity to be contrary to its nature, because its nature is programmed into its instincts. But man has the capacity, that's unfree. In other words, let's translate. Let's use different terminology. Either you're in line with your nature, in which case you're free, or you're not in line with your nature. Now, if you define your nature as being an animal, that's one thing. But if you define your nature as being a Tzelem Elokim, then the only person who's free is one whose Tzelem Elokim rules over his instinctual component. And he's living in line with his real essence. His real essence is to be a being who perceives the wisdom of God and has a relation with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. So why did the Jews accept? Because they were so fascinated? Because they were able to appreciate the true beauty, the true benefit? The answer is no. That's Kaf Aleihem HaKadigas. That's what Chazal is trying to say. At this point in time, it was impossible for the Jews to accept the Torah, except out of fear. The Jews were marred. The only the difference between the Jews and the Gentiles at that point in time was situational. Two things. The Jews had undergone the experience of the enslavement, and when a person is a slave and he's deprived the opportunity of any type of emotional gratification, that's when he starts to look at other values. That's why Chazal say you should be very, very careful. You should treat the aniyim with a lot of concern and compassion and dignity, because why? May aniye Yisrael yotei Torah. Who produces the scholars? The aniyim, the poor, because they have nothing else. See, wealth is not such a great blessing. Well, the truth is, there's a lot of, you see, if there's a lot of benefit in being poor, because a poor person is not distracted with the imaginary benefits. He doesn't have television, so he has to take out a safer, he has to sit and learn. I mean, how many times, if you look back in your own life, how many situations where you were deprived of any opportunity? I mean, you must have had situations where you stayed somewhere, whatever, and you really had no opportunity to do anything except learn, and then you got totally involved in learning, and you realize that that's more fun than anything else you could do. How many times people live, we read about it all the time now, because there's a lot of people that live crazy kind of lifestyles, and because of it they wind up in jail. And then when they're deprived, and they can't, you know, they can't run around anymore, they can't pursue all their dreams, they're forced to stay in the cell, so finally they discover there's a library. And they start reading, and they start learning, and they start getting immersed. And then they realize that this is unbelievable, it's a fantastic thing. They start comparing how much they had to run around, and how much energy, and how much waste of time, and aggravation over nothing, and the amount of pleasure was minimal. All I have to do, if a person develops a skill, there's not much you have to have fun in life. All you have to do is have a little place, and open up a safe for now to learn, and you're in a totally different world, you're having a great time. And it's free. It's a crazy world. You see, now, the Jews were willing to listen, because the Jews, at least, they had been freed from their addiction to physical pleasures in the triumph. That's a situational phenomenon. That plus the awesomeness of the miracles. That's the fact is that God revealed, God was too overpowering in a sense. When God reveals himself to you in that way, with such a powerful manifestation, so it instills fear. And what are you going to say? No? How can you say no? You have no choice. So for those two reasons, due to the fact that the Jews were on a bit of a higher plane, because they were willing to listen, that's the whole idea of the Avdus, that they put them in a situation where they were willing to consider the possibility of a different way of life. And also the awesomeness of the miracles, that's what Rashi said, because of the awesomeness of the miracles. So they accepted it. And that's the first level of Pharisee. The first level of Pharos was to give a person the opportunity for a behemoth to live a human life. That's freedom. Freedom from being a behemoth. Freedom from being an animal. That's the first level of Pharos. But the truth of the matter is, well, this is the great, what can you do for a person? Well, what's the objective? I've said this many times. You know, people are trying to be Makar of others. Everybody's into that. They're trying to be Makar. The objective of Kira is not to make a person a from Jew, so to speak. What's the objective? The objective is, well, you can put it in one, to put him in a state of conflict. To put him in a situation of Bechira, so that he now he has the opportunity for Bechira. Beforehand, he was an animal. He was a slave. He didn't even have the opportunity for Bechira. He was leading a totally animalistic life. But if you really reached him, if you really conveyed to him, communicated to him, and showed him where he's wrong and what the true ideas are, so now, at least, and he understands it and he sees it, so now he's going to have to be involved in a battle. He's in a state of conflict. Because he still has the emotions. Just because you can prove to a person beyond any doubt that the Torah is true. You can prove to a person beyond any doubt that the Torah way of life is the best way of life. A person can be intellectually convinced that all this is true. However, does this mean to say that he wakes up in the morning and his emotions are the same and he still has the same desires? Or when it's true. You know, when a person is free, Allah lukas, when a person is involved in learning. That's why the Gemara says, Barasi Yetzahara, Barasi Torah Tavla. It's a very interesting thing. The Gemara talks about this. You know, how the effects of Torah, how long does it last? When a person is fully immersed in learning and he sees it clearly, then he's really, really free. Then there's no doubt in his mind. And if you experience those moments. I mean, each person, I'm sure, has experience, does experience. There are certain moments when it's so clear to you what the truth is that it affects you not just intellectually but all of your emotions, and then it removes all the pain. That all the pain you experience because of the deprivation, because of the envy, because you don't have this, because you're not a success, because you don't have the other things. But you are a success, but you feel you're not because you don't have enough of the imaginary good. You don't have enough of the unnecessaries in life. That's what causes most pain that people feel, is because they don't have enough of the unnecessaries. Not because they don't have enough of the necessaries. Everybody has enough of the necessaries. But you suffer because you feel that you don't have enough of the unnecessaries. But then when you're involved in the world of learning and you experience that good, then you really feel great. Then you feel you've got everything. And the things you don't have, you don't have any desire for them. You just don't, you know, you don't experience that. You see, I mean, if a person who's full, who's satisfied, okay, does not have any, when do you feel that you're lacking in terms of food? When you're hungry. But then when you've eaten, you don't feel any hunger anymore. You don't feel that you're missing food. You don't feel you're missing out on food. Well, the problem is that you're living your whole life as though you're missing out on food, but you're really not missing on food. It's just in your mind. The only thing you're missing is the imaginary. And everything you're striving for is the imaginary. And all the aggravation you have in life is because you don't have enough of the imaginary good. In other words, you don't have enough illusion in your life. That's the problem. Now, the point is like this, that in that sense, it's chayrus olam. That a person has the opportunity to utilize the Torah to live a free existence. By virtue of the fact that he's kovesh es yisrael, that he can conquer the yetzer, that the yetzer is still there. We're still involved in a battle with the yetzer. And in that sense, I think that's what Malki was referring to before. That's one level of freedom. The first level of freedom is freedom from living an animalistic existence, which is not even human existence. So when God gave us, when God relayed to us and gave us the Torah, so it means that he established and he set it up in a way that it would be permanent. Kilo tishakach mitizaro, that the Torah would never be forgotten. So at every point in time, a Jew has the opportunity to seize onto the Torah and to live a life of freedom through what? Through the conquest of the emotions. Through the conquest of the yetzer. And that's what we say, that requires, that's a tremendous thing. We have to give praise to God for that. That's lo asav asenu b'vad gal. Because God set up a system which relates to us. You see? So in that sense, we're free. But there is a sense in which we're not free. There's a sense in which we're not free. In which we're not free is that's not the real objective though. We're still in a state of conflict. And the energy is really directed towards the instinctual. Of course, as a person perfects himself, I mean, even in the current situation, as he perfects himself, so more and more of his energy will flow towards the love of the good, towards the love of wisdom. Yeah, but essentially, we haven't transformed our nature. So to the extent that we haven't transformed our nature, to the extent that we have not succeeded in educating our emotions, we've educated our mind, and the mind controls the emotion, but the emotional energy is still directed towards the instinctual, to that extent we're enslaved. So that is the whole idea. And that's to the extent that the entire world is motivated by the false philosophy, so this also has an effect upon our emotions. So it's one thing is reinforcing the other. So we really cannot achieve the ultimate good. We can't achieve the ultimate state of freedom that the Torah intended. And that's the whole transition. In that sense, Hashata Avdi, we're still slaves. We're slaves because we have the greatest good. We're sitting on oil. We have this tremendous source of wealth, the Torah, and we don't partake of it. How many Jews really partake of the Torah? And even those Jews who do partake of the Torah, to what extent are you partaking of it, and to what extent are you still involved in slavery? You're enslaved. And to the extent that you're using all of your energy and wasting your energy in pursuit of that which you don't need, in the pursuit of the imaginary, to that extent, you're a slave. So how many people of a tree have utilized the Torah to achieve true freedom? That's when we say, Hashata Avdi. And therefore, if a person really appreciates, that's why the objective, the whole essence of the Seder of the night of Pesach is really to give over the Masorah. That's the night which was designated. That's why the child is really the most important person. And if you can't have a child, then it's a good idea to invite someone who really is not learned, who doesn't know anything about Judaism. You know, to teach them the fundamental principles. That's the night of the transition of the Masorah. And when a person reaches that level where he has a real appreciation of what Torah is, even if you're not, you see, even if you haven't attained the freedom, but intellectually you can appreciate it, that's an extremely, extremely high level. Because most people, even if you, as I said, even if your emotions are not fully in line with the knowledge, but the tragedy that we face is that the overwhelming majority of people, including the Jewish people, can't even accept the point. They can't even see intellectually that their way of life is false. They feel the pain, they suffer from this way of life, and therefore they're depressed and miserable. But when you try to explain to them the reason, and you try and show them that the whole value system is false, and that the only true value for man is Torah and perfection and knowledge, they can't even see it. They can't see it. There's very few people that can see this point. They still will insist that their way of life is correct. And why are they still unhappy? Because of X, Y, and Z. And as soon as they make X, Y, and Z changes, as soon as this comes about, the new situation, the new job, the new house, the new country, go to Israel, whatever the case may be, the new fantasy, then they'll be happy. They cannot see the point. At least what the Torah demands is that you should be able to recognize and appreciate the Geula. People like that can't appreciate the Geula. Because what's the big deal? What did it do for them? They can't appreciate it. It's just a burden. But ideally, a person should be on the level where at least intellectually he can recognize. But that's step number one. Step number one is not to distort the truth because of your own emotion. To be able to recognize him intellectually. And then the battle begins. See, when you've attained that, so you're on the level of Bechira. Until now you had no Bechira. And most people, in my opinion, don't have Bechira. Because a person can't have Bechira until he recognizes the truth. If a person doesn't recognize the truth, then what's the Bechira? It's just a choice between which emotion you want to live by. This emotion, you want to go by the other emotion. It's just a question of which emotion will dominate. But that's an animalistic form of existence. So then, when a person recognizes the beauty of Torah and the opportunity of Torah, so then, of course, he has to reflect upon the ultimate. That is to say, whenever a person recognizes the good, he wants to partake of that good to the highest possible degree, so then he has to recognize that the situation that we're in right now is not the ultimate state of freedom. It's a great state of freedom, obviously. And of course, a lot depends on the individual. To the extent that you manifest it, to the extent that you live in line with Torah, to the extent that you're osek the Torah, the greater the freedom, even in this situation. But we do have a certain barrier. And that is to say that the world that we live in is structured in such a way that we really can't attain the ultimate freedom. But a person has to look forward. That's the whole idea of the Hallel. We look forward. This is the time to appreciate the fact that this situation will not be permanent. That God has a plan for history, God has a plan for mankind. And that when God created man, he created him for a purpose, and he gave him the opportunity to thwart that purpose because he has Bechira. And therefore, to that extent, the world of man is not fulfilling its purpose. The world of man, the whole purpose of this world is to proclaim the glory of God. Just like the heavens, Hashemayim Asapim Kavod Keil. The heavens declare the glory of God because they don't have choice. So the fact that they operate in accordance with orderliness, with wisdom, and so on and so forth, this bespeaks the Creator. But there will come a time when the world of mankind, that's the ultimate expression, the ultimate proof for the existence of God has to be in the world of mankind. And that's the Yemos HaMashiach. That's how it finds its way into the Seder. You see? So that's the second Hallel is really for the Geula HaSida, and it all follows naturally. That a person appreciates, he understands the purpose of mitzvot. That's Pesach Matzah Marah. that these mitzvot are not simply arbitrary restrictions, but they are tools by which you restrain the emotions in one area and redirect them into the world of ideas, and that is the true freedom of man. And therefore, then you appreciate what took place, that when God gave us, took us out of Mitzrayim and gave us the Torah, he established the possibility of human existence for us. Before that time, there was no such thing as human existence, because he gave us freedom. But now we're involved in a tremendous struggle, because we're now in a state of conflict. And therefore we can't realize and maximize that freedom to the ultimate. So then we look forward to the fact, in praising God as our Creator, that God did envision a time in which we'd be able to obtain the freedom to its fullest extent, and that's Yemos HaMashiach. That's the concept of the two geulos, of the geula of Mitzrayim, you see, and then there's the geula ha'asida, which means to say that man will not only realize these points on an intellectual level, but they will permeate the emotions. That's what the Ramban refers to as the circumcision of the heart, that God will, the education of the emotions, that there won't be a state of conflict anymore, that the emotions of man will be fully in line with his knowledge. And then it'll be complete. Then it'll be harmonious. Then it'll have the ultimate existence. It can happen today with only Yechidim, like Avraham Avinu. Very rare. Very rare. That's something else. Very, very few people can reach the level of Ava. Even Talmid Yechidim, the Rambam says. But Yemos HaMashiach is a whole new epoch. You know, a whole new society. Okay? I mean, we could discuss it more because, as I said, there's differences of opinion as to the content. What type of changes between the Ramban and the Rambam. But as far as the Seder is concerned, that's how it fits in.